May it please the court, my name is Kylie Dunn, registration number 40638, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Arzabala. I'd like to focus on the first issue in my opening brief, which addresses instructions 21 and 23, and whether or not these erroneous instructions warrant reversal. It's clear that these instructions are incorrect statements of the law applicable to vehicular assault reckless. The state does not argue otherwise in its answer brief. The question for this court is whether there is a reasonable possibility that these erroneous instructions contributed to Mr. Arzabala's convictions for reckless vehicular assault. And the answer to that question is yes, there is such a reasonable possibility. Just briefly, Mr. Arzabala was charged both with vehicular assault DUI and vehicular assault reckless. He was convicted only of the vehicular assault reckless charges. Briefly, I'll start just by, going through why these instructions are incorrect. Instruction 21 says that the crime of vehicular assault, generally speaking, is strict liability. While that's true for vehicular assault DUI, it is not true for vehicular assault reckless. Reckless vehicular assault is not established by conduct alone. It requires a finding of a reckless mens rea. And instruction 23, which is even more problematic, states that it reiterates that it's a strict liability crime, and then it says that proximate cause for the purposes of vehicular assault, again, generally, means that the voluntary act of driving the motor vehicle while under the influence of alcohol, as defined in instruction number 16, proximate cause means the voluntary act of driving a motor vehicle while under the influence of alcohol, as defined in instruction number 16. It then goes on to say the prosecution is not required to prove that the intoxication affected the driver's operation in a manner that results in a collision. This is simply wrong.
Let me ask you a question about instruction 21 for a minute. First of all, under the elemental instruction for vehicular assault reckless.
Yes.
That was a correct instruction, wasn't it? Including the mens rea.
That's true.
So under a plain error standard, mm-hmm. Even if instruction 21 was somewhat confusing, why would it be reversible error?
Instruction number 21 is reversible error because although they were given the correct instruction, which gave the element, and they also had another instruction that defined recklessly, this instruction purported to be an elaboration on that instruction. It's very clear that it says, this crime is one of strict liability.
But then after that first sentence, it goes on and it talks about things such as it only has to be voluntary, which clearly would relate to the issue of vehicular assault DUI, which he was acquitted on.
I don't think that it's clear that the instruction only applies to vehicular assault DUI.
I don't think it's clear either. That's why we're here.
But they were required to make a finding of a reckless mens rea. This instruction says they don't have to do that, that it's established by conduct. And I think there's a reasonable possibility here that they made their reckless vehicular assault conviction, they reached that verdict through the filter of this incorrect instruction.
Does instruction 21 actually say that they don't have to have a mens rea?
It says that it's established by conduct alone. In instruction, I think it's number 20, goes through and says crimes generally are established by conduct and mens rea. And then this instruction says all that's required is a finding of conduct. So I also think that does that answer your question? Okay. I think it's also to look at instruction number 23. I think that one is even more problematic than instruction 21 because it defines proximate cause entirely in terms of drinking and intoxication, and takes the quality of the driving and causation out of the jury's analysis. And really what matters for a reckless vehicular assault conviction is the quality of the driving, and that the quality of that driving, the bad quality of that driving, resulted in the collision.
Counsel, given that there was a separate elemental instruction on reckless,
yes,
and on DUI,
yes,
isn't it reasonable to assume that the jury would have read this as saying, oh, this links up with the DUI because it's talking about driving while under the influence of alcohol? How would that, what basis would there be for them to confuse this with the reckless charge?
Well, I think, first of all, there's no reason, there's nothing in the instructions, or I think importantly in closing arguments, that told them that the two charges were separate and clearly differentiated for them the findings that were necessary for this reckless vehicular assault conviction. I think that, you know, this instruction tells the jury that intoxication alone is enough to establish proximate cause. And they're given that definition in general terms. They're not told that it only applies to vehicular assault DUI. It certainly does reference instruction number 16, which gives the elements for driving under the influence. But I think that under the facts of this case, they could have found that it was not proven beyond a reasonable doubt that he was driving under the influence, and still, through because of this instruction, instruction number 23, thought that the reckless element of vehicular assault reckless was established by intoxication alone.
How could that be when one of the big issues at trial was the issue of speeding, and there was all kinds of evidence about that, both parties argued about that, and indeed the prosecution argued that that was one of the factors that caused him to be reckless. So I don't see how there was a reasonable possibility that the jury could have just focused on the drinking with respect to the reckless charge. They certainly may or may not have taken that as a factor as well, but wasn't speeding a big issue here as well?
Well, I think that the trial really focused on his drinking and whether or not he was under the influence. I also find the second sentence in instruction number 23 to go to your point, that it says the prosecution is not required to prove that the intoxication affected the driver's operation in a manner that resulted in the collision. You know, part of the prosecution's theory was that he was under the influence, and one of the ways you could tell that was that he was speeding.
There are differences, though, between intoxication and simply drinking. I mean, clearly the jury found that he was not intoxicated because they acquitted him on all of the DUI charges.
Well, I think the jury clearly found that he was not under the influence, and that was the term that was defined for the jury, I believe in instruction 19. They were never instructed on the definition of intoxication. And that term appears in this instruction number 23. And I think a layman's understanding of intoxication, well, varies wildly, but could include just drinking. And the evidence here is uncontroverted that he was drinking. It was the amount that was in question. And so I think, you know, looking at this instruction, they could have said that actually this is telling us that intoxication didn't have to affect his operation. Well, here it did, because the prosecution was trying to say he was speeding. And they did need to make a finding that he was speeding in order to find that he was guilty of this charge.
But he was speeding. Even under the defense expert, he was speeding.
Under the defense expert, he was speeding, I believe her estimate was 39 and a 35. It was certainly a question for the jury whether 39 and a 35 constitutes reckless conduct. And I said this already, but, you know, the jury didn't receive any guidance from either counsel during closing regarding how to apply, you know, how to apply the law or any indication that these instructions did not apply to vehicular assault reckless. In fact, the prosecution relied on instruction number 23 in closing and said very simply, we're not required to prove that his intoxication caused the accident. They were required to prove that his speeding caused the accident, and their theory was that his intoxication led to his speeding.
You mean in the closing argument, the prosecutor argued that in order to prove reckless vehicular assault, it's assault or homicide, I'm sorry,
yes.
They didn't have to do anything other than prove that he was drinking in order to prove recklessness.
That's right.
That's what the prosecutor argued.
The prosecutor did not differentiate between the charges in closing.
Okay.
And I would just like to briefly add to my argument that I made in my reply brief that this is not invited error by pointing the court's attention to pages 150 through 154 of the December 2nd transcript. That was the part in the record where the prosecution specifically asked for the language in instruction 23 that I'm arguing is problematic. They specifically asked for the second sentence, the prosecution is not required to prove that the intoxication affected the driver's operation. And then the next day, defense counsel asked for a change in the wording of that first sentence, but I maintain this is not a substantive change to instruction 23 that at all bars review.
Setting aside invited error, though,
yes.
You don't dispute that there was no objection, so this is a plain error analysis.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you.
And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Excuse me. May it please the court, Wendy Ritz, registration number 17024, representing the people in this case. I'll turn to the first issue since that's seems to be the focus here. And I'd start out by noting that if the defendant's failure to object to the instructions is not seen as a strategic choice, then plain error would be the applicable standard of review. And the defendant must then identify an error that was obvious and so undermine the fundamental fairness of the trial as to cast serious doubt on the reliability of the judgment of conviction. We also need to look at the instructions as a whole, and even a deficiency in any particular instruction, if the instructions as a whole adequately inform the jury, a singular deficiency does not require reversal. Now, it's true that vehicular assault, DUI, is a strict liability offense, requiring only voluntary conduct, while vehicular assault reckless requires a showing that the defendant operated his motor vehicle in a reckless manner. So to the extent that instructions 21 and 23 suggested that both forms of vehicular assault are strict liability offenses, there was a deficiency in the instructions. However, when we look at the instructions as a whole, these instructions were offset by the proper instructions that were given. The jurors were properly instructed on the elements of the two types of vehicular assault in instructions 10 and 11, were given a correct definition of proximate cause, and were properly instructed on the affirmative defense of intervening cause. While instruction 21 did not differentiate between the two types of vehicular assault, it suggested that vehicular assault is a strict liability offense. However, I don't understand how a juror would read that as telling them that this undermines or negates the requirement in the elemental instruction that they find that the defendant operated his motor vehicle in a reckless manner. I think as an appellate attorney, when I look at that, I think, oh, that's clearly wrong. That is going to confuse these jurors because they're going to think strict liability means that there has to be no showing of recklessness. But that's as an appellate attorney. As a lay juror who's reading these instructions, I don't think they saw a link there at all. I don't think there's anything in instruction 21 that expressly told them ignore the requirement in the elemental instructions that you find beyond a reasonable doubt that this defendant operated his motor vehicle in a reckless manner. I just have a hard time seeing how a juror would come to that conclusion. I'd also like to note that in closing arguments, in rebuttal closing, I think, the prosecutor did on page 54 in the December 3rd transcript late instruction number 10, which is vehicular assault, DUI, with instruction number 23, talked about them together, and I think linked them together for the jury. The prosecutor told them, if you look at instruction number 10, it will tell you that for vehicular assault, DUI, we must prove that the defendant operated a motor vehicle while under the influence of alcohol, and this conduct was the proximate cause of the serious bodily injury to another person. What is proximate cause? Well, that's explained in instruction number 23, and goes on to review that with the jurors. So I think the prosecutor clearly linked these together, as did the language of instruction number 23, including the references to intoxication and driving under the influence. So I think the jurors understood the links. In fact, I think if you look at the acquittals on the driving under the influence, if these jurors had read the instruction in the way the defendant suggests they did, I think they would have thought they had to acquit on everything because they did not find that he was driving under the influence. So if they felt that the only way to find probable cause was a set forth in instruction number 23, I think he would have been acquitted of everything. It's clear that the jurors did not read it that way. And I think the language of instruction number 23 lends itself to an understanding that it applies to the vehicular assault, DUI. And again, I'd like to emphasize that if you read these instructions as a lay juror did, it's difficult for me to understand how anything in either of these instructions, which did not specifically refer to instruction number 11, somehow showed the jury that you do not have to find that the defendant operated his motor vehicle in a reckless manner. The jury instruction, the elemental instruction, clearly made that plain, and the jurors returned a verdict in accord with that instruction. And there was clear evidence of recklessness at trial. Not only was the defendant drinking while he was driving, he was speeding. The defense expert even admitted he was speeding. The defendant himself said he was probably going 30, 40, maybe 45. The prosecution expert, their findings were based on the fact that the defendant braked. Both passengers in the vehicle said that the defendant braked, which suggests that the prosecution expert's analysis was more closely related to the actual facts, and the defendant was going at least 45, if not possibly 60, at the time of the accident. In addition, there was evidence that the defendant was distracted by his passengers. So there was certainly abundant evidence of recklessness, which the jury could use to find that the defendant operated his motor vehicle in a reckless manner. So the evidence clearly supports the verdict.
Let me ask you a question that relates somewhat to that, although it's not on the instructional issue. It goes to one of the arguments about the prosecution's closing argument. And apparently the prosecutor indicated that the victim had pulled out of a driveway two or three times. That apparently was not the case, and you pretty much concede that in the answer brief. So take me through then your plain error analysis regarding that particular statement.
Sure. It's true. It's improper for a prosecutor to misstate the evidence. Here the evidence suggested the victim, who was able to testify about that night, said, you know, we were parked by the side of the road, and then the driver apparently decided she wanted to pull into a driveway, so she was turning around. So there was some suggestion of a driveway. However, it is clear that the prosecutor misspoke when they said that the driver was pulling out of a driveway.
And the evidence was, I take it, undisputed about that. I mean, the jury couldn't have been confused about that, could
they? True. And the jurors understood that was for them to determine the evidence and the facts, and understood that the closing arguments are not evidence. And defense counsel had opportunity to object and ask the court to remind the jurors of that fact, but did not do so. I don't think there's any way the jurors, that would have somehow misled the jurors or overpowered their ability to remember what the evidence was. And I think the basic point of the prosecutor's closing argument was valid. Whether the driver was backing out of a driveway or was just turning around, the prosecutor's point was, when you're driving in a residential area such as this, it's foreseeable that someone might be pulling out into the road. And that's why we have a speed limit of 35. It is foreseeable that this might happen. And that was the prosecutor's basic point, which was not undermined by the fact that the prosecutor confused the evidence. It was a reasonable explanation of foreseeability versus not foreseeability, and it doesn't rise to the level of plain error, particularly when it would have been very simple for defense counsel to just interrupt and say, Your Honor, I think the prosecutor seems to be confused about the evidence. The court at that point certainly would have told the jury, you heard the testimony, it's for you to decide what the evidence shows. And that seems like that would have pretty much cleared up the matter at that point, but defense counsel didn't do so. So under all those circumstances, it doesn't rise to the level of plain error. I guess I'd like to again emphasize that there's nothing in instruction 21 or 23 that to a lay juror would tell them that they did not have to find the defendant acted recklessly. And if the court has no further questions, then I would simply rest on the brief as to the other contentions raised and ask the court to affirm the defendant's convictions. Thank you. I'd first like to address the state's argument that the instructions as a whole cure the errors here. I think the case law is clear that when there are inconsistent statements of law that are given to the jury, we can't presume which of these statements of law the jury chose to follow. And so therefore the fact that there were other correct statements of law does not mean that this is not reversible error in this case.
I guess as I heard the Attorney General's argument, it was that there is no inconsistency here.
Well, I think that's incorrect. I think there is an inconsistency. If you say in one instruction that you have to find an element of reckless conduct, and in another, reckless driving, and in another, you say, actually, the prosecution doesn't have to prove proximate cause by reckless conduct. They have to prove it only by the voluntary act of driving while under the influence. And they don't have to prove intoxication affected the manner in which the driver was driving. I think it's important to recognize that use of the word manner. The only other place that appears is in that element in the reckless instruction. I also want to point out that this instruction number 23 apparently came from People v. Grassi, almost word for word an instruction that was used in that case. And in that, that was a vehicular homicide DUI case. And in that case, the Grassi court found that it wasn't error there because they had other correct instructions, but it did note that there would have been a better way to word that instruction. And I think that this court should keep that in mind. Secondly, or maybe thirdly, I think that under the facts of this case, the jury could have found that he was not under the influence, and then also found that proximate cause was proven by evidence of drinking or intoxication. There was no chemical testing here. There was no roadsides. There was no observations of any other bad driving. I think it's entirely possible that the jury decided that charge quite easily.
But there was evidence of bad driving. He was speeding.
Well, the collision itself. But this isn't your typical DUI case where you have a police officer observing other bad driving they can add into their analysis. And I also want to just take issue with the state's characterization that there's clear evidence of recklessness here. There simply isn't. We had conflicting experts giving fairly conflicting estimates of what his speed was. And in a case where speed was the evidence of the reckless driving, not his other reckless conduct, it was his reckless driving that had to cause the accident. There was not clear evidence of recklessness. And if the court has no further questions, I ask the court to reverse.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. This case will now stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.